This is Chantal Cecile Kira, and I'm the moderator for tonight's teleseminar. I'm calling in from San Diego, and I know to all of you, the ones calling at least from back east where you've had these horrible weather storms that I've heard about. I have heard from many people who have had no electricity, basements flooded. It doesn't sound like very much to hear about a little rain, but out here it seems like the phones have not been working in Southern California. The roads have been blocked. So I am not complaining, but I do appreciate the fact that we haven't built things to deal with weather out here. I'm really proud to... What, Lisa?
Go ahead. I was going to say we're having an unusual snow here in Oregon, and we're all sort of snowbound in our homes today.
It's kind of a perfect night to have this seminar if people do access to listen in. So our guest this evening is Lisa Lieberman, who has a master's in social work. She has a family. She also is blessed with a son with Asperger's. And she is here today to talk about the holidays and how we can create meaningful holidays with children on the spectrum, because we all know that it's not always so easy. So, Lisa, would you like to tell the audience a little bit more about yourself?
Sure. Well, I've actually been counseling, I've had a private practice on and off for 30 years. Was doing garden variety counseling with garden variety neurotic people like me and you. Is that okay to say that about you, Chantal?
I think that, so.
That we're both garden variety neurotic people, so... And then it turned out that my life created a passion, and that was the result of realizing that I had experienced different kinds of challenges and disabilities in my family from every possible role. I had a grandmother who had a stroke and who survived for 5 years and was nonverbal, and my father had a heart condition most of the time that I was growing up. Of course, I didn't think about this much until later on. My only sibling was a brother with paranoid schizophrenia who unfortunately took his own life. My husband has an advanced case of multiple sclerosis, and I have, as you said, I'm blessed with a wonderful 20-year-old son, Jordan, who has an autism spectrum difference. And so, obviously, I realized that I learned a lot about living with disability in a family, and that informed my decision to specialize in that area in my practice. But truly, my greatest love is working with parents of children on the autism spectrum.
Lisa, you're the author of a book called A Stranger Among Us, and it's an invaluable resource for all of us families that need to hire outside people to help us with the people that we care for. And I don't know if you want to comment on that.
Sure. That book was based on, again, partly personal experience hiring people for my husband for the last 20-plus years, and my son hiring one-on-one support for him to come in and do a variety of tasks. I realized after doing that for over 20 years that I seemed to know something about how to effectively and positively hire people to support my family members, as well as stories that I've gotten from speaking nationally and work in my private counseling practice. So I appreciate you mentioning that.
Well, we have so many questions here, but I know that I wanted to ask you to speak a little bit about what it's like, Lisa, preparing for the holidays with children on the spectrum, and also what we have to think about in terms of when we need help from others.
Okay, that's a big question. Let me just start rambling a little bit. I think a lot when we think about balancing the experience of the holidays for our family and making a positive experience, that people tend to think of that mostly as how do I meet my child's needs to make things run more smoothly. And, of course, that's important to attend to that, because if our kids are calmer and more able to manage themselves things are going to be easier for everyone. But I think there's more. I'm also very much a proponent of parents addressing their own needs. And I think one of the things, Chantal, that gets us in the most trouble during the holidays, it's such an emotionally laden time, is the expectations that we carry about how it's supposed to be. And those expectations, unfortunately, when you have a child on spectrum or a young adult on spectrum, overlook the mass amounts of sensory assaults that a person on spectrum might face. It challenges their comfort with predictability and routine, and it's, in many ways, it's very much to ask of our kids, although there's a lot of enjoyment as well. We have dreams, we have expectations about what it's supposed to be like, and when the reality doesn't match up, it can be hard and disappointing and even painful. So part of our task, I think, in preparing for holidays with our kids is to redefine what is, quote, normal, unquote, for your own family, in much the same way that an IEP is supposed to be individualized for our child. We also need to define what our holidays are going to look like based on the individuals in our family. And that issue of trying to live up to the dream, and as I mentioned before, can cause some pain. And I kind of have a story that that's kind of related to that issue. Oh, probably it must have been at least 10 years ago. My husband and I were doing a keynote at an Oregon conference, and it's a very much of a touchy-feely, close sense of community kind of conference. And at the very end, a lady came up to me, and she said, "Can I give you a hug?" And I said, "Of course, I love hugs." And as she was hugging me, she said to me, "You have such a wonderful family." And I was very surprised at that moment to realize that I wasn't walking my talk, because something protested inside of me when she said that. And I started to think to myself, oh, no, I don't have a wonderful family. My husband has this advanced case of MS, and my, you know, I went through all of the things that were, quote-unquote, in my own mind, broken about my family members, and realized at that moment, at that transformational moment, what I was doing, and realized that I do have a wonderful family. It's just different. And for us, that is what's normal. And so a lot of the pain comes when we start comparing what we have and who we are to what we see other people have from the outside. And that's another issue, is that we look at people from the outside and we think we know what it's like for them from the inside. But everybody has their struggles. Everybody has their challenges, whether or not they have a child on the spectrum. But we don't realize that sometimes, because we're caught up in what are very real challenges. But when we tend to compare ourselves to other people, that causes a lot of pain.
Yeah, and also, I think that just from personal experience, I'd like to say that even without having a child with autism in the family, holidays, especially the Christmas, Hanukkah holidays, whatever you want to call the winter holidays to be politically correct for everyone, is a moment of heightened excitation. And right. Everyone's excited, and everyone has these expectations. So even in the best of times without the children with autism, there's already all those disappointments, or people living, trying to live up to certain expectations that can create disappointments if they haven't kind of dealt with that whole aspect of what the holidays should be realistically for the family. So then you add the autism in the mix, which, depending on what your person with autism is like, can be really difficult, because there's the person with autism, as you were saying before, the different needs, the need of the person with autism, the need of the parents, and then the needs of the people that you're spending the holidays with. And it's really about compromising and making it work on as much as you can in your comfort zone, and what's going to make, the way I look at it is trying to get it so that everyone has a little bit of something, one something that they can hold on to, that can represent the holiday for them or sharing the time together. And if you can't make that happen, then you have to look at alternatives.
Right. And I think that once you can let go to some extent of comparing your family to other families,
right,
you know, some of that compromise mentality kind of slips away, and you really are looking at who are we really, and what's really going to work for us. And I realize for people who are listening right now that right now we're talking in generalities, and my hope is that we will get a lot specific with ideas.
Right.
And those ideas not only are going to come from us, but I know there were some questions that were sent in ahead of time, and there were some people who already had some wonderful suggestions that I hope at some point, Chantal, you will mention, because we're all in this together.
Right.
I just think that, I mean, one of the points, and of course I'm a psychotherapist, so you have to forgive me. I look at the things from that perspective. You don't really have to forgive me, but you know what I mean. And I think people need to really kind of get right with themselves about where their dreams are coming from and, you know, how much of our dreams are we imposing on our kids that may not be as much of a loss for our children as it is for us. And I think that's an
right.
important
because
question.
Because they have a different image, or they don't already have an image about Christmas in their minds.
Right.
Or
right.
Hanukkah, whatever the holiday is that the people are celebrating.
Right. But that isn't to say that they aren't challenged when they go to the relative's house and they get smothered with kisses and their sensory system is just so overloaded, or, you know, all the smells, all the different kinds of food, all the gifts. And, you know, I do think that our kids deserve and need to be protected until the point that they can start to speak up for themselves on their own behalf. And in my book, I have a chapter about how do we start building self-advocacy with our kids from a very young age. And I think it's so important that we start as early as possible to do that, but I'm kind of getting off the subject there. And, for example, I saw this. A couple of people asked questions about, well, what if my child doesn't want to sit still and wait for people to open gifts? And what I learned with a 20-year-old son on spectrum is that a battle worth fighting? Is that so important that we insist that our child do something that goes against their whole nervous system for purposes of making everybody else feel comfortable, you know, in their own minds because of their expectation about how our child should be acting? I mean,
right.
A long time ago when my son would have his birthday parties, and, you know, they'd tell us we'll invite 30 kids so that maybe he'll get some invites back, so there'd just be this overwhelming number of people and an overwhelming number of birthday presents. And we learned very soon that we would only have him open the gifts from the kids who really felt strongly that they needed to have that gift open that day, and that we would just take our time, and maybe it would take him 10 days, and he'd open one or two a day. And he was able to appreciate it. It didn't feel like a burden or a demand that was too much to ask of him. So by the same token, maybe it's too much to ask of our kids, especially younger ones who their nervous system hasn't developed enough yet. Maybe it's too much to ask of them
Hello?
To sit and open a bunch of gifts or watch other people do it, even though it's been a family tradition.
Okay, I lost you for a second there, Lisa, but I'm glad to hear that you're back.
Oh.
Okay, can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine.
Okay, great. Well, before we start hitting on responding to the specific questions that have been sent, I just wanted to spend a second bringing up the suggestion about the chosen family or choosing other people to pass the holidays with. And I want to touch upon that just from another point of view that has nothing to do with autism, but I left the United States to go live in France because my relatives are over there when I was first married with my husband. We went over there. And, you know, Thanksgiving to me is one of the most important holidays, and they don't celebrate that over in Europe. And so what would happen is that all of us expats that got to know each other in Paris would put together this huge meal, and it would be like a month in the planning, and we would invite all these Americans that were by themselves. over the holidays and over the, just for that Thanksgiving, because at Christmas time you could usually find other families that you know, the French practice Hanukkah and also Christmas, and so it's easy to find families to go celebrate with, but not at Thanksgiving. And it was interesting, my reaction when I came back to America 13 years later, I found it really difficult to reconnect with my family over Thanksgiving, because over the years in France, first I had no children and then I had my son, but everyone was kind of used to him over time. And when I came here, my family was no longer used to dealing, they had never dealt with Jeremy on a daily basis. And so it's really hard to organize this Thanksgiving meal, first of all, with people that I was forced to have Thanksgiving with, and not that I chose to have Thanksgiving with, but also the fact that I now had Jeremy, but people around me who didn't know how to react with Jeremy around. So I don't know if that segues into something about speaking about chosen family.
Well, I mean, some of the questions that people sent in, they talked about in-laws who were highly critical of their child's spouse and, you know, subjecting themselves to a situation where they felt criticized. And then when they had their child with autism who was having some anxiety, having some behaviors, and so then the daughter or son-in-law gets blamed for bad parenting because of the child. I mean, I would think, Chantal, that we have such a strong value on family in this country that people are going to want to feel that they've done everything in their power to try to make it right. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm going to use an analogy much the same way that we do when we're trying to work with a school. And before we have to uproot our child and take them to another school, we really try to get the professionals to work collaboratively with us before we upend our child and put them someplace else. And by the same token, I think people want to feel like they've done everything they can, and I really hope we get to talking about some ideas about what people can do to try to get extended family to, quote-unquote, get with the program. And at some point, we just may realize that we're going down a road that just isn't going to take us anywhere, and that the only choice we have is to turn around and go down another road. And that's when we start thinking about the idea of chosen family. I think I mentioned to you in a previous conversation that I have two older children who I raised from my husband's first marriage. They lived with us. And one's in Seattle, and he's a cook, a chef. And the other one's back in Connecticut with her family, and she couldn't be out here with the kids, so we really felt kind of orphaned this year, and I was kind of feeling sorry for myself, and I talked to my husband and my son and said, you know, let's look at some opportunities for volunteering. Let's do something for somebody else. Let's make this holiday meaningful in a way that really matters and that makes sense. And I mentioned to you when we were talking that we couldn't find anything to do at that point. It was like too late. But in the meantime, we ended up talking to some people who were close friends. And when they heard we didn't have any plans, all of a sudden we had two invitations. And that's what I think about in terms of chosen family. That it may not work out for whatever reason, because of geography, because of people just not understanding our children's needs, that at some point we just have to kind of put our hands out and say, wait a minute, why am I pushing the river here? It's time to try something else and create something that's meaningful, that is more respectful of the individual needs of everybody in the family.
Right. I agree. Okay, so now before we start taking the specific questions, which is where we will be giving, and you will be giving specific ideas to families on how to help with make their holidays meaningful to their children. I did want to mention that a lot of the questions that came in had to do with sensory issues or dietary issues. And I would like to refer people back to either Brian King's seminar or I did a seminar on OT, which dealt with a lot of the sensory issues. And also, I think it was Betsy Hicks who spoke about dietary interventions. So I'm not trying to avoid answering those questions. It's just that we're not perhaps the best people to speak specifically to, for example, dietary intervention. But we will be keeping those questions because perhaps that'll make for another seminar because there seems to be quite a few questions, especially about the sensory. But I would suggest that people listen especially to Brian King's seminar.
And he did a great job of articulating a lot of sensory issues, and I think it's well worth listening to if you haven't already. I think a lot of those questions will be answered. Can I say something else right now?
Go ahead.
Okay. We were talking about trying to make it work with family before you kind of decide to go down a different road. I think that another skill that's involved with that, and this is something I talk about a lot when I travel, is the skill of asking for help, and that takes many forms. And being comfortable with understanding that I think sometimes our family members want to help, but they don't know how. They feel inept. They feel uncomfortable. And unfortunately, we as parents get put in that role once again of having to be the educators about what would be helpful. And so I think that is that's a skill that needs to be cultivated. And the other thing about that is if you have somebody who doesn't quite know the right thing or they want to hug your child or they want them to open the gifts or whatever and you try to do some educating about what works best, I think something that also goes a long way is to acknowledge the positive things they do. For example, being able to say to Uncle Joe, who you know has struggled with your child, "Well, Uncle Joe, it's really nice the way you got down on Jimmy's level right then. I could see how that made him feel very comfortable." And as much as we don't want to have to work hard all the time, I mean, I think just comments like that make people feel successful may also help to bridge some of those gaps that occur. So I just wanted to throw that out there.
That's important to hear. Okay, so I can start now?
You bet.
From Harry in Stewartsville. "How do I get my family members to understand that people whom he hasn't seen in a while might cause a meltdown? I know that he wants to hug him or kiss him, but he doesn't like to be touched. I don't want them to feel hurt by his actions."
Well, I think advanced planning is some part of that, and not waiting until the time that it happens or a few minutes before it happens, but actually maybe writing a letter ahead of time or having a conversation ahead of time. There's some wonderful resources on the web to help explain to people. I did a search because I wanted to prepare for this, and I found if you guys haven't read the letter that starts "Dear Friends and Family," it's a great letter written in the voice of a child on spectrum to send to relatives and hosts of holiday gatherings about what to expect. And if you do a web search, I did this on Google tonight just to make sure it would come up, and it says "Dear Friends and Family," and then put a plus sign and put autism. And this letter will come up if you haven't seen it already. And I think something like that, modified to fit your child, could be very helpful. Now, what I'm talking about now is some of the things that we can do in advance to prepare people and to make positive suggestions of what to do if you see them having a meltdown. The best thing, you know, let people know that the best thing is the fewer words as possible and just kind of keeping things calm and moving on with whatever other people are doing. And because when a child is that far gone neurologically, and that's really what's happened in the middle of a meltdown, they're not going to respond to more words. And our tendency when our child is starting to get more upset is to use more words and to get louder and louder, which is exactly the opposite of what's going to make a difference. So if we can somehow explain that to people ahead of time. You know, another resource that I think is very good for that is Christy Sakai's book, Finding Our Way, her last name is spelled S-A-K-A-I. She has a whole section on dealing with extended family, and she gives lots of really good ideas about how to help family to understand children's needs, whether or not it's during the holidays. It could just be any time in general. Which leads me to another point, is I don't think that this is something that should just happen right before the holidays. I think this is something that can happen all year long. Maybe somebody writes a newsletter and emails it to close family members to let them know the kinds of therapies that are being done, or the kinds of challenges, or the kinds of little steps to celebrate, so that the family members are kept up to date, especially if they're far away, about what is going on, and they feel a little bit more part of it. You know, sometimes you're going to find people who are so close-minded and who just say all that kid needs is a good spanking, and there's nothing you can do to change their mind. You know, much like people in this past election, a lot of them had their mind made up, and there's just some cases where you just didn't even try and change their mind about who they're going to vote for. And that's all I'm going to say about that, but anyway. And then that's the case where we might be looking at choosing family rather than trying to be with our biological family.
But I think it's also helpful to try and prepare the child as well, because one thing that I learned from listening to people like Brian King and others on the spectrum that I interviewed for my book, Autism Life Skills, is that many times the thing that was most upsetting to them was transitions and not being prepared. And so even though we may not have an idea sometimes if someone does not have good expressive communication about what their level of understanding is, the fact that you try every day to explain using a social story, either visually or verbally, to the child with autism about what's going to happen. So maybe it's not going to help the first couple times, but eventually he'll understand, coupled with explaining to the family with the letters that Lisa just spoke about. Because the point is the child also is going to have to get used to, over time, a little bit more of what's going to happen. It's sort of like the way you prepare a child going to a dentist's office, because nobody likes to go to the dentist. And so think of
and it takes
for them, for someone on the spectrum, it can be horrendous, as if it were going to the dentist's office to go to a Christmas or Hanukkah gathering. And so
it takes repetition. You know, that leads to a question. I just want to, there's a question that was asked of me right when I got on this conference call, before you even got on, Chantal. And I wanted to respond to this mom, because she was saying that her child does really well in terms of transitioning into the holidays, but the problem is transitioning out of them. So when it's time to put away the decorations, it's very difficult for him. And I think sometimes we'll do a good job of giving our kids warnings about how it's going to, you know, that it's ending, and to give them a warning so they can get used to it. But I also think it's helpful when you're giving kids a warning that the ending is coming, that you also give them some information about what's coming next. So, you know, it might be an example of, well, we're going to have a New Year's Eve party, and then we're going to, you know, be blowing noisemakers, and everybody's going to be dancing and be real happy when it becomes the new year. And then the next morning that we're going to get up and we're going to go to have brunch at Grandma's house, because that's something we always do on New Year's Day. So in other words, not only are we giving them a warning about something ending, but we're also telling them what's coming next.
Right.
I think sometimes that can be very anxiety-provoking if they don't know what's next. I can remember dealing with that with my son. He had a favorite video, and he'd be sitting on Dad's lap, and the minute the video ended, he would be, the behaviors would come, and be crying and screaming. And we actually had to have an expert come in because it was so daunting and so difficult. And he asked us this question, well, did he know what was next? And I don't think necessarily we should expect our kids to remember that just because they've been told that they need the visual. And this particular mom said they did show their son visuals about the fact that you know, that Christmas would be over and they'd be putting things away. But I think it's also good to show visuals about what's coming when something else is ending.
Well, when you think about it, too, and I don't know this particular family, but if it was a child who enjoyed certain things about Christmas, like my son likes the really shiny decorations and the blinking lights in the tree, well, what about even us supposedly neurotypical adults, you know, how we suffer from the holiday blues? You know,
uh-huh.
It's well known that there's a higher rate of depression in January, so it kind of makes sense that, especially people who don't really understand what's coming next, you know, if for them it has been nice, and there's been parts of it they really like, it's going to be hard for them, especially if they don't understand what's coming next, to transition. So that's an important aspect. And I'm going to start. After another question, can we move on? We have so many questions.
You bet. Go ahead.
Okay. So this is from, I think it's pronounced Jorge, from Houston. How should parents select toys for a child on the spectrum? My son is interested in just items that look like snakes or are just elongated, thin shapes.
I don't consider myself an expert about that. I can only talk about from my own experience in doing that. But I would say that one of the things you might want to be thinking about is what are the skills that that child's working on. For example, if they're working on cause and effect and on their IEP, or with somebody who's working with them privately, then it would be wonderful to have toys that demonstrate the cause and effect in a very concrete way. I think selecting toys according to interest. And, you know, I'm not quite sure, you know, my creative juices aren't flowing enough to think about how could you use the long, skinny, snake kind of shapes in creative ways. But, well, you know, maybe some of those, what are those little arts and crafty things called that twist and turn and they're kind of fuzzy and they're long and they got wires inside of them? I can't think of what
they're
called.
I don't know what they're called. Oh, pipe cleaners.
Yeah, like pipe cleaners. And maybe doing something with that or counting them or building things with them so that they're still using the long, skinny shapes, but they're doing something else to expand it. I mean, the thing that I've always learned is take whatever the interest is and expand upon it, but don't take it away.
Right.
So to try to get creative in that sort of way, but I don't claim to be an expert about that, Chantal.
Well, I have two thoughts about this. Is first of all, because my son's 20, and my son is very impacted by autism, and I'm to the point where I'm surprised that he's a voting age, and I'm still talking about toileting issues, but that's not something we're going to talk about tonight. But I also have this dilemma during the holidays because I think, first of all, I want something that's practical, that's going to teach him something, that's going to move his interest, whether it be elongated shapes or string, forward. But then I also think, you know what? It's the holidays. They're allowed to have fun, too. So maybe it's
right.
Not correct to say, and I'm sure that a lot of people will think that this is terrible that I did. But finally, I got so sick of trying to get gifts or having his sister try to find gifts that he was not interested in, that we decided to make some gifts that he was interested in. And it was the best thing my daughter ever did for my son. She took straws and she taped different colored ribbon, lots of ribbon to the end, so he could just flick it, you know?
Uh-huh.
It was not at all appropriate, and it was really stemmy, but you know what? It was the best toy he ever had from Rebecca. And you know what? It's the holidays. Not everything can be educational. My problem is stuck at a motor level where, for example, puzzles. He can only do certain types of puzzles independently in terms of how many and how big the pieces are. But there are baby puzzles, and he has gone past that. But I have found out that there are places on the Internet where you can actually have puzzles made with your pictures that you choose. So I'm going to try and get some of those for him where the pictures are more appropriate of his age, but it's something that he'd be interested in so that he can take them around with him and they don't look so babyish. Because that is a concern when, you know, my son is finishing high school, and so sometimes he needs to keep busy while he's sitting for 2 hours in a mainstream class. So what do you give him to keep himself occupied so he doesn't have to get up and walk out the door, but if he's only interested in baby toys? So it is a dilemma that I deal with. But you kind of have to balance when it is the holidays between something educational and something fun. So I always think of going to educational stores and looking at those shapes. So what is there that are snakes or elongated that maybe can be twisted and built into something else? And,
right.
But, you know, like you were saying, cause and effect is great, too. Here's another question from Mary Schulnard South from Paris, Maine. Hi, Lisa. First, I would like to say I read your book, A Stranger Among Us, and I got some wonderful tips in managing our in-home support staff. Great book.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mary, wherever you are. Now my question. About 3 years ago, we had a holiday dinner at our home for extended family after Christmas. It was a disaster as our son, who was aged 9 at the time, was trying to get the attention of his older cousins. Yes, it was in an inappropriate way, but not bad, and the cousin, age 26, handled it very badly to the point where my husband wanted to throw him out. We didn't, and it was eventually worked out, but now I am so paranoid that something will happen again. How do I explain to relatives that our son might behave this way to fit in and that he isn't being a brat? Thanks and my best to you, your husband, and your son. P.S., how is your son doing these days?
My son's wonderful.
okay,
so again...
Yeah, so you understood the question?
Totally, yeah. And the question, it points to the need for advanced planning and communication. Because, again, I wouldn't try to deal with this with people at the time. I'd be very proactive in communicating with all the parties involved if possible. It's a two-pronged issue, and as you said before, we can't just put the responsibility on others. We also have to put some responsibility on our children. And if a child is speaking or verbal, I would do some role-playing with her son ahead of time about what are some productive ways to get someone's attention. And you know, even to exaggerate it and have fun with it. And, you know, maybe say, well, is this a good way to get your attention and do something really obnoxious, you know, and have a good laugh? Well, would this be a good way to get somebody's attention and to actually do some, like I said, problem solving with the child? Because it does have to be a dual responsibility. You know, there's a metaphor that I heard years ago that made so much sense to me, and that is the idea that we have to help people understand with our kids that the wheelchair is on the inside, and that it isn't always visible. And to talk about the kind of challenges that our kids face as neurological, and that if our child had diabetes, for example, that nobody would, you know, purposely, well, we would hope nobody would purposely try to give them sugar to make them sick. And if a child had a thyroid problem, nobody would try to get you to withhold the thyroid medication. And I could go on and on with all those kinds of examples, but somehow because it's above the neck, it gets minimized as less important, and that we need to find analogies like that that will help people to understand that this isn't about them doing things on purpose, but that they truly are doing things that the best they can. And so that would be one suggestion, but again, to do it ahead of time and have that conversation.
Right. Here's another one. Kathy Allentown from Pennsylvania. I dread going to my in-laws because my kids refuse to sit at their table. Half the time they have meltdowns because we are forcing them to stay at the table. How can I get my kids to stay at the table during dinner?
Well, I think I spoke to this before. I think those rules need to be examined. And again, why are we asking this of our kids? Are we asking this of our kids because it's something that the in-laws expect? Is there something that our children can learn from this that's really going to benefit them? Or are we asking them to put themselves into a situation that is neurologically so uncomfortable that it's going to create an incredible amount of anxiety. I mean, that's another example of the wheelchair being on the inside. And that maybe ahead of time you talk with the in-laws and say, you know what, we're really trying to work up to helping our kids learn to be able to tolerate sitting at a table. And we would like to have them sit for, you know, 3 minutes or 5 minutes, and we really need your help with this. And that if they sit for 5 minutes at the table and then need to get down and go do something else, we're going to celebrate that. And would you celebrate that with us? That might be a way to engage them in understanding from a different perspective what it's about.
Yeah. It is. It's really a lot about expectations. And I know it's really hard because you try and want to keep Christmas or Hanukkah the same and keep the holiday gatherings the same. And then there's this anxiety because you know that your child's not going to be fitting in the way everyone wants the child.
Remember
to,
what I...
You know, yeah, exactly. But the point is, I'm just emphasizing what you said before, Lisa, because if this
it's
was
the comparison that gets us in trouble.
Right. If it was a one-off occasion, then you wouldn't really worry about it or care about it or spend so much energy and time preparing people about it. But the point is, this is going on year after year. So perhaps the first time your relatives aren't going to get it and your child's not going to get it, but after the second time or the third time, they will. People will get used to it. And if they don't, if they're not going to open their minds to being open to the fact that not everybody can see things exactly the way they can, then it's time to rethink what you do on your holidays.
Yeah, we need to figure out how to help our extended family have better theory of mind. I'm sorry, that was a bad autism joke.
Yeah, I always think it's so funny because it's always the people who are supposedly neurotypical who are the most inflexible in terms of their expectations, you know. Okay, so here's another question from Sarah in Superior, Wisconsin. Every year I watch my 4-year-old son being overwhelmed by Christmas Day activities. He was diagnosed last April with autism, and we still have trouble with acceptance of it from certain family members. This holiday season, we understand why the past few years have been so difficult, but as much as we try to explain it to others, no one seems to truly want to understand or accept what they need to do differently to make things easier for my son. My in-laws are obsessed with giving as many presents as they possibly can to my children, and each year we watch my son sit in the back of the room and withdraw further and further inside of himself while the gift-giving is taking place. What can my husband and I do to help our son, since no one in our extended family wants to give up the holiday celebration they have become accustomed to? A loud celebration filled with loud noises, strong-smelling foods, and gifts stacked to the ceiling has become a nightmare for my son.
Well, I think, pure and simple, and they're asking, everybody's asking too much of that child. You know, again, I'm sorry to be redundant, the wheelchair's on the inside, and if their sensory system is not calm, and there's just too many demands, and there's routines that aren't there for them that give them comfort, what other way do they have to communicate? And I think that so much, one of the things I can say about having been parent to a child with autism is that so often, like when you take parenting classes, the parents come to the class and say, tell me how to fix this kid. But really, it's about the parent having to make adjustments and learn to be a partner with their child and learn to work with them and help, you know, protect them until they can speak up on their own behalf. And when we ask things of our kids that they are neurologically not able to do, and then turn around and have people get upset with our kids because they're not able to do it, there's something very unfair about that. And I'm not in any way trying to increase anybody's shame. God knows that parents of kids with autism already get enough accusations about what they're not doing the job right. But I do think that to keep doing the same thing over and over when it obviously isn't working, it's important to try something different. And maybe that is, again, with some advanced planning, saying, you know, we're going to, Johnny's going to come for about 20 minutes, or if this is hard to do on Christmas, but maybe there's a caregiver who celebrates a different holiday, who would come along and help that child, you know, take them out, or we ourselves take them out of the room so they can calm down and not continually be subjected to all that input. I don't know if I'm making sense.
Well, that's a great idea. In fact, it is really hard for us to find people on the holidays to help us with Jeremy, who requires 24-hour support for most of these reasons that we're talking about here. But my husband and I just kind of take turns if we don't have somebody with
right.
us. Okay, so yeah, it is a pain. And of course, it is not the normal life that we wish we had and we had dreams and hopes of having. But, you know, it is what it is. And, you know, when you
right.
think about other situations that other people have, you know, everybody has something. And so my husband and I just communicate about taking turns. And I've gotten over the fact that, you know, he's not going to do it exactly the way that I would do it. And I find every moment to be a teaching moment, whereas my husband cares for my son and doesn't really teach him anything. But you know what? I'm glad my husband's still here taking care of my son for
right.
me, you know?
Right,
so
right.
It's, I don't know if it has to do so much with the way things are in America with competition and everyone has to be the perfect kid. I mean, I say this because I have a daughter who's 16, who's neurotypical, and even just for her, when I see what we're supposed to be doing to prepare for high school preparation for college,
uh-huh.
it's so different from when we were in high school. I mean, everything's so much more competitive and everyone has to be doing so well, and their skill set levels have to be so high. And then you think of that kind of pressure being put on families who have special needs kids, and it's
right.
really hard. I think at some point it is hard because you go out in the community and you're always hearing about these other families and these other kids, and you just have to realize that what you have is different. And I've sort of grown a like turtle shell on me, or like, I don't know, is it ducks that when you put water on them, it just kind of flows right off?
Water off a duck's back.
Water off a duck's back. And, you know,
yeah.
you have to get tough over time, and you have to develop that, because otherwise you will be depressed and you will be unhappy. And you know what? I refuse to live my life that way. So I kind of figured out that nothing's perfect, and I'm going to do the best that I can. And sure, it's hard sometimes. I mean, New Year's Eve—that's a holiday that's really important to me, and that is one holiday that it's very rare that we actually get to celebrate. And over the years, we've managed to find chosen family or people to celebrate New Year's Eve with, and they're usually other people who have special needs kids. Because who wants to invite a couple with special needs kids to have a New Year's Eve party with?
Well,
you know,
people that really get it and really understand the beauty of diversity.
Right.
Hey, you know, that reminds me. There was something that just came on the email today. I wanted everybody to know, if you don't already know, there's this incredible website called gratefulness.org, G-R-A-T-E, gratefulness. And every day they send a beautiful quote. And it was so amazing because the one they sent today pertains so much to what we're talking about. So is it okay if I read that, Chantal?
Yes, go right ahead.
Okay. It says, if we are to achieve a richer culture, rich in contrasting values, we must recognize the whole gamut of human potentialities and so weave a less arbitrary social fabric, one in which each diverse human gift will find a fitting place. And you know who wrote that?
Ooh.
Margaret Mead,
oh,
anthropologist.
Isn't she the one who said something about it's a group of people that can change?
Right.
I can't remember the quote right now, but it's something having to do with a small group of people can change the world. In fact, it's the only thing that ever has.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah,
that was her. So anyway,
okay, I'm sorry. I'm going to go on to another question.
Go ahead.
Are there any suggestions on how to manage your child in noisy crowds and gatherings during the holidays? This is a year-long dilemma, but it seems more prominent during the holiday season. Now, I know we've answered that a little bit, Lisa, but I have something to add to that if but I'll let you go first if you had something you wanted to mention here.
Well, earplugs, for one thing. If they need to put something on their ears, I mean, I know I have so many friends that are adults who have autism, and they are smart enough to know that if they're going to be subjected to certain kind of lights, they wear a hat to shade their eye, they wear earplugs, they do whatever they can to protect themselves. And so that would be one suggestion that I would have if they have to be in that environment in the first place. Go ahead.
Right. Okay, I know this has a lot to do with sensory stuff, but again, preparing the child with not only social stories and explaining, but also with the fact that, because let's face it, sometimes we have to go shopping and we have to take our child with us who has a terrible time, you know, especially around the holidays, because there's always something to get at the store, and if there's no one to watch your child, you have to take your child with you sometimes. Well, what I tended to do with Jeremy, which was really helpful, is I always told him ahead of time. And I had no idea when he was little how much my son understood because he couldn't really express himself. It was only later in life that he could, that I figured how to get him to communicate. So anyway, I would still explain to him, and also I would play for him some of the types of music he might hear. You know, those music, carols and the noisy kind of music that you tend to hear in malls. And I would play them for him, which is really more like torture. Not even just for him, but even for me. But the point is that it just got him used to the idea that, oh, when we go to stores now, it's going to be more like that. And also the idea that it was going to be crowded and noisy. And I never, and also the other thing is, because I always tried to go out in public with my son looking as neurotypical as possible, which meant no stemming allowed, which means that I wouldn't allow him to leave the home with a little piece of string or his favorite little animal that he would flick. Books are okay because you can look at books and still look appropriate, but you know what? Forget it around the holidays. There's no way my son would go out shopping and not have a brightly colored little piece of something in his hand, because otherwise what do you think he's going to do in the stores? He's going to grab all the colorful decorations that are up and around. So you have to kind of like choose your battles, right? Don't you agree, Lisa?
Right. Absolutely.
So.
And we have to ask ourselves, whose problem is it if our child's flicking something in public? I mean, if it's our own embarrassment that interferes, you know, again, like you said, that's maybe not a battle worth fighting.
Right. I have to say, I think that I'm a little immune to a lot of that kind of wondering what people think, because I don't know if many people know this about me, but years before having my son, I used to work at a state hospital in Orange County in California. And I actually worked with the first group of teenagers that were going to be deinstitutionalized into the community. So we used the street trial to teach them community living skills and functional living skills. But I got used to going out with a group of people who didn't look neurotypical, and I was teaching them out in public how to act in public. And the point is, in those days, you didn't see people out and about that were different looking. And we're talking about 25 years ago at this point. And so I just got used to people staring at me. And so even now when I'm out with my son, if people are looking my way, I always think, did I drop food in my shirt? You know, is there a button unbuttoned or something? I always forget that my son may be acting a little bit differently than they're expecting. But, you know, as I say, you just kind of get over it at some point. Okay, we have a lot more questions here.
Can I just ask you, are there a lot of questions coming in as we're talking? Because it's kind of weird not knowing if what the things we're talking about are helping or helpful to people who are listening.
Well,
so are you getting feedback?
I'm not getting feedback, but people are asking more questions. Like here's a cat from Allentown who sent in another question. How do I keep my daughter from having a meltdown because she wants to open other people's gifts? That's a great question.
Wow.
In other words, her daughter wants to open other people's gifts.
Right.
I don't know how old her daughter is, though. I wonder if she mentioned
Pardon me?
It in a...
You don't know how old her daughter is? Is that what you said?
Yeah. But anyway.
Because that would make a difference, because if you have a very small child, you know, it might be a matter of, you know, how they have in the preschools, the kids have a very concrete place they can sit. They sit on the square, or they can't go over this line, and it might be necessary to put you know, if they're really a small child, that to put gifts that are for them there, and that anything over that line is not, is an area that is not their area. So there's a very concrete understanding of the boundary. Again, it might be a situation where it's too much to ask of them to put them in that position. Again, depending on the age.
Right.
And
I would have to ask, why is she opening the other people's why does she want to open other people's gifts? Is it because she wants to see what's inside, or is it because she wants the sparkly
paper?
Okay,
right.
Because I could see right now that my son, he when he was younger, did not have a sense of this is mine and this is yours, but he loved sparkly paper and ribbon. So now he's gotten very good at not touching things that are not his, but it took many years.
So it's not really about what it's about, or what we, it's not about what we think it might be about, in other words.
In other words,
so
yeah, I know from this question if it is because she wants to see what's inside, or she wants the gift, or she just wants the paper and the ribbon. Because if it's about the paper and the ribbon, then that's an easier fix, because she can have her own paper and ribbon to play with.
Exactly.
Okay, I'm going to continue here. There's so many questions, it's hard to decide which one to ask next. Here's one, it's not, okay, here's one, but I wouldn't even know where to look, but maybe you can figure out an answer to this one. This is from Moraine in South Ozone Park. Are there places that formulate holiday get-togethers for families with children of special needs in the New York City area? Well, neither one of us is based in New York City, but I'm just trying to think of
Unequivocally, there would be places in the New York area. They could be religiously based. If this person has a particular religious affiliation, there would be gatherings. There would be support groups. So often we'll have a holiday celebration for kids. Obviously, because we're both on the West Coast, I'm just actually typing it into my computer right now as we speak, just to see what comes up.
Here in San Diego, we do have different churches and synagogues that do have different holiday celebrations. But we also have the Parks and Recs, which will not have a religious celebration, but they'll do something, say, on New Year's Day or at some other time during the holiday season, which is not a religious holiday, but it's still a reason and a way for the families to get together. But while you're looking that up, can I go ahead and ask another question?
Oh, no, please.
Okay. My son has, I think this is from India. My son has PDD, notes and sensory processing disorder. Every year we go to my in-laws, and there are so many people. I sent emails this year on ways they can help our son feel more relaxed. The problem is my in-laws have even more people coming and don't see what the big deal is. They also want it to be an all-day thing. My husband sees nothing wrong with this. He will be at work and will join us later. Well, no wonder he doesn't see anything wrong with that. I know our son does not do well with a lot of people, and all the noise there is never less than 40 people around. Then they get upset when our son gets upset. I thought about not going, but then my husband will get upset. Sounds like there's a lot of upset people. Maybe martinis would help.
No, I think that...
Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead,
were
Lisa.
Were you done?
Yes.
I think, again, that's an unreasonable expectation to put on the child. And this mom intuitively knows that this is not in her son's best interest. I mean, obviously, I'm a counselor, and there's a problem in that the husband and the wife need to get on the same page, and that's not always easily done, and that's not what we're talking about tonight. But I wouldn't. If she knows in her own wisdom that that's not in her child's best interest, sometimes we got to take an unpopular position. And I realize that may be a very different thing in the Indian culture to take that kind of position, but it would still be hard even in the United States, so it isn't really just about that. And if you know in your heart of hearts that that child is not going to do well in an all-day celebration, you just take a firm position and say, I think we're going to wait till so-and-so gets off work, and we'll see you at 6 o'clock and come for a few hours. And people can want what they want, but they aren't always going to get it. And we have to go with our own wisdom as parents about what's best for our kids. And that's my answer to that.
I totally agree. Here's a question from Zakaria in Doha. How do I get my son to try to open up his gifts?
Well, again, I've talked earlier about how they may need to be spaced out. You know, I think so often we take for granted that our kids understand what it's for. What is a gift for? Well, they may not understand the concept of gifts. So therefore, you're putting this box in front of them, and it has a ribbon and it has paper. But if they don't have, if they're missing the cognitive concept of what a gift is, then what's the motivation? And it may be that during the year, and when you're home, you have a few gifts and you practice opening them in front of your son and then acting maybe really excited when you open it up. Or if your child brings you a flower, you know, you call it a gift. I mean, just, and again, like Chantal was saying earlier, using lots and lots of repetition. So I wouldn't assume that they really understand what a gift is for. Does that make sense?
It does make sense.
Okay.
I just realized that that question actually came from Terry in Stewartsville. And there was a different question from Zakaria in Doha. But it doesn't have to do with the holidays. Do you want me to ask it for you anyway?
Are you talking to me?
Yes.
If you think it's go ahead.
It's what is the difference between rituals and
idiosyncratic
attachments in children with autism. Is that a question you can answer?
Well, I kind of can, yeah. I mean, my first answer is I'm not sure it really matters. I mean, if you decide that it's a ritual, which is something somebody has learned to do over and over again for comfort, or if you decide that it's an idiosyncratic attachment, well, isn't that possibly also about gaining comfort? So I'm not sure that the distinction is important. I think it's just going to be a matter of first of all, the thing that I always learned with my son, and I haven't talked much about him. I mean, I talked about him as wonderful and everything, but it wasn't so wonderful when he was 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years old. It was really, really hard. But what I learned was, no matter what, once I've entered into a power struggle with my child to try to get him to stop doing something, he will always win. That the minute I've entered into a power struggle, and that's true for any kind of parenting, actually, but especially with our kids, if try to get him to stop doing something, he will be relentless. He will continue it, no matter what. He will find a way. And so we have to ask ourselves, what is that about? Why would it be important, first of all, to identify whether it's a ritual or an idiosyncratic attachment? It might be that we need to narrow the amount of time that's spent doing it, and we can do that so often with our kids with visual. I got distracted because my dog's trying to get in my office here. We can do that with visual calendars of when they're going to be able to do that ritual or have that item that's so important to them. I think a lot of times the anxiety for our kids in not being able to do those things and not knowing when they're going to be allowed to do them is much greater, and that if we can give them as much information as we can about, you'll be able to line up strings, you know, between 6 and 7, or you'll be able to, whatever, I can't think of examples of rituals right now. And then my son had them, and He really needed that. That was his way of gaining control over the world. And as long as he knew that there would be time, he was eventually able to shrink the amount of time he needed to spend doing those things.
It's really hard because also sometimes when they have, the, at least with my son when it comes to rituals, is that sometimes I can see that it's a calming thing for him, and other times it's not. It's like he can't get out of what he has started.
Uh-huh.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
It's trying to figure out when it's something that's helping him and when it's not. And,
right.
But it is true that they always need to know when they're going to have that. You can't just take something away forever. They need to know that they're going to be able to do that at some point. Here's a question from Carrie in Michigan. You know, as parents of autistic children, we are always giving up everything to make our children comfortable. Christmas is one time through the year that I refuse to stay home and not go to my in-laws. When our son was younger, it was god-awful. Now that he is 8, he has gotten better. However, now he always wants to play video games even when we do our normal crafts. How can I make him understand that he has to wait till after gifts are open to play video games when he doesn't understand the concept of time?
Well, the first thing I want to say about that is that I applaud the fact that she's willing to not give up what's important to her, you know, that she's not going to let herself miss something. I might question whether making him hold off on video games is worth the battle, which is the same thing we've been talking about. Why can't he just play his video games while other people do their normal crafts? But if she does decide it's a battle worth fighting, then I'd suggest a visual schedule if he's a visual learner so he can know that video games are coming. Because I think, again, a lot of times if kids know they'll have time to do what they want, they can tolerate waiting. You know, this might seem like a really foreign thing to say, but I do think that people ought to consider the possibility of using respite during the holidays and not insisting that their kids participate in every single activity. You know, that's part of hanging on to that dream so tight about how it's supposed to be, when in fact it might be kinder and more respectful sometimes for our kids to be able to stay home with somebody they trust, or to be able to be in another room with somebody that they trust and not be expected to get with the program that everybody else is participating in. And I know that there's a little bit of a broken heart that might go with that, because you really love your child. You want them to enjoy the things that you've enjoyed in your life growing up. But sometimes it might really be more the parent's issue than the child's, and that it really isn't something that's as important to the child as it is to the adult. And that's a question that I, as a parent, ask myself a lot.
Right. So it is true that for something like holidays, that it's something that's going to repeat itself, you know, every year it happens again, you would hope that they would be used to a certain part of it. So, in other words, that they're not always excluded and never learn to deal with a little part of it, but it's all about what could you make work, you know, just a little bit. Like if it would be possible to have a respite person, but maybe they're not gone the whole day, but they can actually come for an hour and then they go.
Right.
Or they get to have a taste of it. Because over time, they can get used to certain aspects of it.
Sure, of course.
Yeah, and I think that sometimes we also think that our children don't have the notion of time, but it's because we haven't really taught it to them in a way that makes sense to them. I always thought my son could not understand time until I realized that when we had support staff and tutors here when he was younger, and we used to have a timer, like, to give him a break, like 10-minute break watching a video. But the timer was mostly for the tutor, you know, because you lose track of time. And it was crazy because after a while we realized that my son was turning off the timer like a second before it would ring. So we'd be sitting around waiting for the timer to go off, and it would never go off, and then you'd look and realize that it had been turned off. And so then the tutor would sit there and wait and actually see him turning it off the second before. So, you know.
Because he wanted more of a break?
Because he wanted more of a break.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know if he was figuring out from reading on the timer, the numbers, or he had a sense of time. But I know that he does have a good sense of time because I'll say things like, you know, like he'll pick up his shoes and say, I want car, and head for the door. And I'll say, no, we can't go right now. We can go in 20 minutes. And 20 minutes later, he'll pick up his shoes and head for the door. So
we have to
And he learned that over time. It wasn't something that he was born with. So I think
right.
he learned it over time for us teaching to him about waiting and about how many minutes he was allowed to do a certain activity. So it kind
we
of
have
helped.
To be so careful about not making assumptions about what our kids can and can't do. And
right.
in fact, I will say to you now that one of my least favorite words in the English language is the word realistic, because anybody
yeah.
who ever says about our child that something isn't realistic, they're putting a lid on his dreams and my dreams for him. And I'll accept the word reasonable. That may not be a reasonable goal, but it's nobody else's business. And I realize that I've gone off topic here, but it's just such an important thing for people to be telling us that what is or isn't realistic for our children. Our job is to hang on to the dreams and work towards dreams until they can take ownership of their own dreams. So
right.
I'll stop now.
That's okay. I have a question that there's still a bunch of questions here, but I'm surprised there's one question that I want to bring up that I have not seen come in yet, and I can't believe that I'm the only family in the world dealing with this issue, is that I have a son who loves sparkly things, so guess who likes to take all the ornaments off the Christmas tree the minute your back is turned? You know?
Uh-huh.
Anybody? Have you dealt with that before, Lisa? Did your son enjoy taking the Christmas tree ornaments off the tree when he was
little?
Well,
quite frankly, we aren't of that persuasion, so, you know, we weren't hanging around a lot of Christmas trees. But I can imagine any other time. You know, it's like you would do, I mean, what do you do with a child who's younger developmentally? You just redirect. Give them something shiny to play with.
I'll teach you something about Christmas trees. They usually are in the living room area. So, you know, we live in California where there's open floor plans. You can't close the door. I don't know if there are other people out there who are dealing with the same issue, but what we
are putting one of those baby fences around the Christmas tree when people aren't right there so that they can't get to it.
No, but, you know, it depends on how old your child is, of course, but we learned to put our Christmas tree up higher, you know, like on another, on a piece of paper. So anyway, okay, that was a little segue. I know I'm not here to talk about my situations, but I wondered if anybody had that problem with their ornaments. Maybe my child is the only child who likes to grab things.
I think that's a really common problem.
What? Lisa?
I said I think that's a really common problem, even for kids not on spectrum.
Right. Yeah, but when they're littler, see, my son continued to do that for many years, even at his ripe old age now. Okay, here's a question coming to us from Germany. It's from Melissa Horn-Ansbosch. My family is a constantly moving military family stationed in a small town in Germany with little support or resources, oceans away from family and friends. My oldest is 8 years old with classic autism, and I have a 7-year-old, a 6-year-old, and a 3-year-old. It is terribly difficult for us to have holiday traditions, as this Christmas will be the first in 7 years that we're not traveling to visit family or moving. And we actually get to have Daddy home, too, this year. Well, that's good. Amazingly, all of my kids seem to come through the trauma of the holidays relatively well, but it is always a trauma, it seems. Do you have any suggestions for my crazy situation?
Well, I didn't follow which part of it's crazy for her. I missed that.
It sounds to me like the part that's crazy for her is that she can't go away to visit the family, and so she doesn't have any Christmas traditions because she used to visit the family. And also, just think of having 4 children of that age.
Sure.
8, 7, 6, and then 3, with the oldest one having the classic autism. But I think, you know, and I don't know anything about her situation, but it sounds like the trauma, she says they get through the trauma of the holidays relatively well, but it always seems like a trauma, but maybe it always seems like a trauma to mom, because doesn't that kind of seem that way anyway? When you may feel worn out and kind of like holding it all together, but for everyone else it seemed to go smoothly because you were there doing everything. So it's really about how do you make things go well without making it such a trauma for yourself.
Without burning yourself out? I mean,
correct.
We can only speculate about what the question is. So,
right.
I mean, if we go with that hypothesis that that's what she meant, it is about doing some proactive thinking about how is she going to get little pockets of respite. Whether that be, I don't know if she's still in Germany, whether there's people available who could help out or whether there are other expats, families that we can get together with. I mean, it's just hard to know
right.
what her situation is. I will say that the greatest support that I have gotten over the years, unequivocally, has been other families of kids with challenges. You know, and especially parents of kids with autism, because we get it. You know, we get together and we can celebrate the small steps together. We can overlook things because we understand that it really isn't that important. And I don't know if that's an option for this person to seek out other families. Again, it's hard to give a good answer without knowing exactly more about what the situation is. So I'm sorry about that.
Yeah. But I think those are good suggestions, Lisa. There's a question or actually a comment that just came in from Jennifer R. from Bel Air, Maryland. This is not exactly a question, but I wanted to comment on what was said about teaching the person with autism to not stim so much in public. I'm a middle school teacher of children with autism, and I'm quite aware and empathetic to my students' needs to stim. However, I also strongly believe, even from my cousin's experience, the child on the spectrum, that we need to teach children to reduce the stimming, or even better, replace the atypical stimulatory behavior with something more typical. I also wanted to let you know how much I appreciate hearing you call my children as others and others with autism as not typical instead of different or not normal. Do you want to answer that first, Lisa, or do you want me to go ahead?
No, repeat the thing about replacing stims with things that are more socially appropriate.
Yeah.
I mean, of course we want to do that for our kids. I agree that of course we want to do that for our children because that's going to be in their best interest. You know, so I totally agree with that. It's just that the issue I was talking about is more getting into power struggles to try to get them to stop doing something because we all know if you take away a stim, another one's going to replace it, and it might actually be even worse. So I think that has to be done in a respectful way that takes into account what need is being met by that stim and how can we meet it in another way that might not be so obvious. So I do agree with her. It's just
right.
The power struggle is where I start to get concerned because, first of all, you'll never win, and second of all, it's just going to create a lot of anguish and hurt.
Right.
So go
and
ahead.
In terms of what I was talking about, stemming, or using the examples of my son stemming, my son isn't allowed to stem when he should be doing homework or he should be focusing on something. It's going to take away from him focusing. But if we're in line waiting at a store and we're going to be out and around for 2 hours waiting in different stores, and that's a choice that I don't have to leave him at home, then he is going to have a book with him that he can look at. Or if it's the holiday season where there are too many shiny objects around, he is going to have something, or I'm going to have it actually in my pocket that I'm going to give to him only if he really needs it. Because there are certain situations, because I know of the bright lights and the noises, where I can't expect him to be on his best behavior. And that would be too much for him. But I totally agree. To me, it's a last resort, allowing him to stem. But I have to understand, or I have to realize that he can't always control it. And when I'm out shopping, it's not a teaching moment. If I'm a teacher at school or my son's at school, that's a teaching moment. then he shouldn't be seven. He should be learning what he's there for.
Maybe just a little variation on that, Chantal, is that how many of us doodle when we're at a lecture? You know, like sitting in a college classroom or sitting in a public, listening to a speaker. And I think so many of us don't just sit there silently and we're doodling, we're thinking about other things, we're doing our own stimming. And so I agree that we could try to make it as much as possible a little bit smaller movement, maybe something not quite so noticeable because we have such an intolerant culture of differences. But I think that we shouldn't ask more of our kids than we ask of ourselves. And
I know, for example, for my son, because I've seen the difference, is that a little stemming can be good for him, but if he is stemming too much and he's not focusing on his work, he's focusing on the stem.
Uh-huh.
And that's being able to differentiate from when it's something that's not really like just a little doodle while you're listening. Because I understand what you're saying, but sometimes it's too overpowering because it's more like a drug. I don't know
sure.
if I can... You know what I mean? And
yeah.
I think that's what it's hard to have hard, fast, cold rules about it, but you have to be able to differentiate what purpose the stem serves. If it is just a little doodle, or if it's really overtaking the whole focus of the child.
And I think our dialogue here, what's really important about this is that there isn't one right answer, and that we're all going to have to do what we can live with, you know, as parents and what we think is in the best interest of our kids. And you're not wrong and I'm right, and I'm not wrong and you're right. It's just so important that we all tune into our own wisdom about what's best. And we're giving two different perspectives here that are valid.
Yeah. And it's so hard when you are working and dealing with family situations. It's not the same as when the child is in school in a more controlled environment. So there's a lot more going on. So here's another comment from Kathy in Allentown, Pennsylvania. This is feedback regarding the sitting at the dinner table, because she had asked earlier about sitting at the dinner table. Oh, she's the one also who likes to open the presents, and she says her daughter is 4. She says, my in-laws do have expectations but haven't supported us at all since my daughters were born. My daughters both have autism. They're age 4 and 5. I do like the idea of discussing it with the in-laws so they know what to expect. So, well, maybe by the time they get a little older, the in-laws will be a little more accepting or understanding.
Sure. I think that parents and grandparents have developmental stages they have to go through. You know, like while our kids are developing, so are we, and so are the grandparents. And we all just have to keep growing up and coming to terms with what we can't change and what we can't control. So
that's a really good point, because we haven't really spoken about that, but a lot of people here are talking about their in-laws or their parents and extended family. But we talk a lot about, well, at least I did in the books that I've written, about the grief cycle and about what parents go through when they have a child with a diagnosis and they get used to the, you know, or they try and get used to the idea that they don't have the child that they expected to have. They have a different type of child. But grandparents are kind of left out of that. But they're kind of going through the same thing, because they have this whole idea of what it's like to have a grandchild and how they're just going to have a good time with the grandchild. And then they realize the grandchild doesn't react the same way. They can't have those moments of sharing that they do with their other grandchildren.
It's double jeopardy. I always say that it's double jeopardy for grandparents, because not only are they kind of grieving the grandchild they don't have, but they're also grieving because their child, you know, their adult child is struggling. And
right.
I think oftentimes it's grandparents or parents of older adults themselves, they struggle with what their role is in this situation, because, you know, they can't tell their kid what to do. But by the same token, they're seeing them struggle, and I think that it's a real dilemma. There was a really good article on the OASIS site, Barb Kirby's site, called Especially for Grandparents of Children with Asperger Syndrome. So I'm hopeful that people know about that site. But if you just plug in OASIS, O-A-S-I-S, it likely will take you to the Asperger site and a good article by Nancy Mucklow called Especially for Grandparents of Children with Asperger Syndrome. And I realize it's not just also about autism in general, but I think it would still be a valuable thing to read. It's about 6 pages.
Oh, that's very good information. Thank you so much. I hope people are having the time to write this down if they're listening. Now, here's a question or a comment, actually, that's kind of off topic, but I have to read it because it's very touching. It's from Jenna in Rosalia, Washington.
Uh-huh.
I have a son who is 6 and who was diagnosed with Kanner type autism in May. My husband and I have struggled through, but we are getting help. As I listen, I am crying because I feel now that there are others out there that struggle with the same challenges we do. My question is, how do I respond to relatives that criticize me about what my son won't eat? Well, the first thing I want to say to Jenna and to everyone out there is that's part of the reason why I do and Lisa does and other people do these kinds of web seminars or the radio show on Autism One or write for magazines like the Autism File is because we don't want parents to feel all alone. I know when I first had Jeremy, even though I had my past experience with autism, it's still you feel so all alone when you have a child that's different from everyone else's, and especially when you get the diagnosis and you're not handed, instructions on what to do to fix your child. And so please don't feel all alone out there. That's why there's Autism One Radio, there's the Autism File magazine, there's these web seminars. There are tons of people out there who are dealing with what you're dealing with. And make connections with other people. Go ahead, Lisa.
I think I have some concrete kind of answers about that. I mean, I think maybe you could put the question back on your in-laws and say, well, you know, it's really nice that you're concerned. Speak to the positive aspects of it, that you're concerned about what my child eats, and I really appreciate that. And can you tell this that you are concerned about and kind of interview them about it instead of you being on the defensive? And just sort of say, well, you know, it's just really nice that you care enough to express your concern about that. And I just hope there's a lot of people in Jimmy's life who are going to worry that much about him. Thank you so much. And in a way, you're sidestepping their accusation, and you're speaking to the positive aspect of the negativity that's coming your way. I mean, it's just one idea for reframing how it's being presented to you. Because the defensiveness isn't going to help. It's going to get you upset. It's going to escalate the situation. And it isn't going to solve anything. So, hey, Chantal, problem. It sounds to me like the battery on my phone is going to go out. And what I may need to do, if it happens, is grab my cell phone and call back, get right back on.
Okay, well, if it happens, if I don't hear you anymore, then I'll assume that's what you're doing, and I'll just keep answering these questions. You get back.
Okay.
We'll just keep going.
This is real life, right?
What?
I said this is real life. We have phones that go out.
Exactly. And I won't get insulted and think you hung up on me because I said something inappropriate.
Not much chance of that.
Okay. So here's a question from Sandy in Altoona. How do we handle this situation? Our daughter is almost 20, and our family expects her to act her age when we all get together for the holidays. How do I respond, or how do I prepare her for these comments?
Can you repeat that again? She's 20.
She's 20, and the family expects her to act her age when we all get together for the holidays. How do I respond, or how do I prepare her for these comments? So that's interesting because it's not just about, responding to the relatives, but also preparing the daughter for hearing these negative aspects?
Well, again, I think as a parent, you need to be kind of clear in your own mind that your child's doing the best they can. I think that's the best assumption. You know, Tony Atwood says that, as a rule, our kids their emotional age is about two-thirds of their chronological age. So if you go by that, what is it? So 20 would be about 13 or 14 developmentally. And that's not a judgmental statement. It's just a description. So that would be one thing. You know, one of the things that I've learned to do with my son is I talk to him about things like that ahead of time. I talk to him about the hard stuff. I'll say to him, you know, honey, there are some of your behaviors having autism that look different to people, and you are going to run into certain attitudes that are going to maybe feel hurtful. And maybe we could talk about some ways that you can respond, some things you can do if that happens. I mean, we've done a lot of talking very frankly about things like that, and I think it's worked out well in our situation to be pretty open with him and to invite him to participate in solving problems that relate to him.
Yeah, I think that's a really important aspect. When you have, as a child gets older, developmentally, you know, it's hard if you have a child that whose communication skills expressively aren't very good because it's hard to know how much they're understanding, but with Jeremy, we always talked to him as if he understood, even though we didn't know if he did or didn't. But getting them involved in the conversation so that they understand more about what's going on and involving them is really a good idea.
Even if they're non-speaking.
Right.
They still understand. We need to assume that they still understand what's being said to them.
Yeah, I'm sorry, that's what I meant. It's like, even with Jeremy, I didn't know what he understood, but we always talked about, we always talked in front of him, to him, as if he understood. We assumed he understood.
Right.
Now here, again, this is a little bit off topic, but I have to ask or bring this up because I always feel for these people. Janice from Kenton, Washington. I'm a single mom wondering how other moms, single or not, deal with the guilt and the worries. I find that it's hard for me to turn my brain off at night, reviewing the day, what went well, what didn't, the to-do list for the next day, and why I can't get all that my son needs. I thought that after 9 years, my son is 11, I would be able to turn it off at the end of the day, but most days I can't. What do you suggest? I'll let you go first, Lisa.
Being able to turn off your mind at night, worrying that you're not doing enough, is that what you're getting from that, Chantal?
Yeah.
Or worried that your child isn't getting enough. I mean, let me just put that in a different perspective. I think all parents feel that way, and please don't think I'm going to stop there because that would really be very annoying if I were you thinking that. All parents feel that way, and then when you put on top of that the issue of being a single parent, there's no go-to person. You are it. You are on. There is so much demanded of you. And then put on top of that the specific challenges of the child. I think it really takes, and I mean this in the most descriptive way and not judgmental, it takes a real attitude shift to really start looking at the difference between optimal, because none of us do what's optimal for our kids, and adequate. And coming to terms with defining your own limits of what's possible. I think if you were my client, if you were coming to me for counseling, that would be one of the things that we were working on, and we would start to be focusing on the things that are going well and not just focusing on the holes and the deficits. So that would be one part of my answer. Another part of my answer is finding some strategies for your own relaxation, you know, whether that be prayer if you're a spiritual person, And remembering that you're not in it alone, and that you can ask for help, whether that's from a spiritual being or whether that's from other people around you. I think that's another important part. Or just learning a progressive relaxation strategy, finding ways to distract yourself. And there's nothing wrong with that, because nobody can be on 24 hours a day. You will burn out. It's so important that maybe if you have a good support system in your life, if you have women friends, sit down with them and say, could you please help me figure out how I can get a mental break before I have a mental breakdown, and not expect yourself to be on 24 hours a day. And, you know, again, without having you sitting here in front of me and knowing a little bit more of what's going on, those would be the two messages, the adequate versus optimal, and the finding some ways to asking other people to help you figure out ways to take care of yourself. One of my pet peeves, and you can imagine with me, I was caregiving my mother for 2.5 years. She was in dialysis and she was dying, and I had my husband with an advanced case of MS, and then my son, Jordan, with his autism. I hate it when people would tell me, you have to take care of yourself. I wanted to punch them. And what I really wanted them to say to me was, Lisa, let's sit down together and figure out some ways that you can take better care of yourself. Let me help you do that. And sometimes people don't see that need, and we need to reach out and say, you know, I really could use some help here. If you go on my website, which is just disabilityinthefamily.com, there's an article that I wrote about asking for help. I do a lot of speaking. There's a couple different articles about asking for help and the importance of interdependence. And I think this issue of interdependence is so important, especially for single parents who are doing so much of it on their own. I could talk about this for hours, Chantal, but
cut you off.
Go ahead.
No, it's great. That was really good information. And now I'm going to give my nuts and bolts. And remember, I am not a trained social worker nor a counselor, so I'm just going to give you, give Janice a nuts and bolts answer as me, another mom, because I am that person who at the end of the day is thinking about everything she didn't get done, or I used to. And then I used to wake up in the middle of the night going over everything that I didn't do and how I hadn't managed to get everything I wanted to get for my son. So I decided I had to change that strategy. And so what I do now, because to me a to-do list is very important because I'm afraid I'll forget things. And I like to get up early in the morning to get my work done, but if I don't have a list, my brain's a little foggy. I may forget what it is I'm supposed to be doing. So here's what I do now is I make that to-do list for the next day earlier in the day, like before dinner. And then after dinner, I don't have to deal with what needs to be done the next day, or at least the hour and a half before I'm going to go to sleep. And then to turn off my brain at night, because I still have that brain working, I actually, I love to read, so I try and have some good books. If I can't, and they're usually books that are so distracting from my normal life. I'm not talking about autism books that are going to give you ideas, but, you know, mysteries or romance or historical novels, or I turn on the TV. Recently, my daughter's friend has been leaving here the whole series of Entourage. I don't know if anybody's familiar with that show from HBO. Now, what a fun show. It's four guys who left New York. One of them's now an actor in Hollywood, and it's all about these guys in L.A. And it's so much fun for 4 hours. It's totally not your life, but it always makes you feel good. And that's the kind of thing that I do right before I go to sleep. So then my brain is turned off from thinking about autism or thinking about my son, because you know what? It's all going to be there the next day. And if you don't sleep, then you're not going to be able to function the next day. And, of course, sometimes I have trouble and I wake up in the middle of the night. So then I have a little book lamp and I have my book and 2 or 3 pages of the book and, boom, I'm back asleep again. So that's the short term, what do I do at night to help me get in the mood to sleep. But other people might have different things. But I find a book or something that's funny or totally out of your world on the television. So, you know, a little fantasy, a little something like that.
Oh, there's nothing like a mindless novel, Chantal.
Exactly. Maybe I'm going to start writing something like that. Wouldn't that be fun?
Yeah.
Okay, now here's a really good solution that someone sent in. This is really good practical information from Nancy, Red Lodge, Montana. She wanted to share her solution for, here, let's see, my five-year-old son with autism who doesn't like opening gifts. So what she does is she has asked all her relatives to send gifts unwrapped. She puts them in a gift bag so he can explore them easily without all that loud ripping. My relatives also enclose a picture of themselves to use as a gift tag so he knows who gave him the gift. That's really smart. The pictures really help him connect his relatives that are far away. That's awesome. That's awesome. That's the kind of supportive relatives you want to have. But you know what? Other people, you could ask your relatives to do that. They may not think about it. But what a great idea. I love that gift tag with the photo and also the fact that they send the gifts unwrapped. But you know what? Even if they sent them wrapped, you could always unwrap them and put them in the gift bag.
There you go.
That's great. Okay. I am looking to see that we have not missed any more questions that have to do with the holidays. But here's one that's not about the holidays, but since the holidays, whether it's Hanukkah or Christmas, has to do with religion, I'm going to bring this question up. It's from Janice Lawrence in Kent, Washington. I've been wrestling with the issue of whether I should even bother introducing Christianity to my son because we have had such bad experiences in church. Even though my faith was waning with my daughter when she was young, she's now 19, I did take her to church and Sunday school, etc. Now I believe in the principles of Christianity, compassion, empathy, non-judgment, etc., but not so much the philosophy. So should I bother if my heart won't be into it, and it will make it harder to expose him to it, and I won't know if he's understanding anyway? What do you think?
I think that if it's important to you, then you figure out a way to go, and if there's a way for your child to be incorporated, that if he is accepted, then and if he has a sense of being embraced by this group of people, then whatever he's getting is going to be valuable. There are organizations that have sprung up all over the country that are trying to help religious congregations to be more welcoming of people with disability. One of the organizations is the National Organization on Disability. They have a bunch of booklets that are available. I think for free there's one that's called That All May Worship. I'm just looking on a website now for National Organization on Disability. They have a religion and disability program, and I would invite you to go to that website and look it up and contact the people who are part of that group and ask them if there's any groups in your area that are starting to do some outreach to families of children with disabilities to be more inclusive, because this movement is happening all over the country. We have a lot of that in Portland, Oregon. I could go on and on about that, but it's definitely out there. Just Google religion and disability or go to the National Organization on Disability and you'll see that. But I urge you, if that's something that brings you comfort, find a way to go. Even if you have to hire a respite or trade with a friend so that you can have that time, that time for you is so important to sustain you and bring you spiritual support.
And also she was talking about the aspect of whether or not she should explain to her son or involve him. But it's true, if it's important to her, she should try to find a way to explain to her son, irregardless of whether she thinks he understands or not. Because as we were talking before, many times people whose expressive communication skills may not be working well, their understanding may be just fine.
I would err on the side of assuming they can understand, because that has been my experience. I know I have so many adult friends with autism, many of whom are non-speaking, and so many of them are incredibly spiritual people. William Stillman has written a couple of books, about autism and spirituality. Autism and the God Connection is one of his books. And there's another one he wrote called The Soul of Autism. And it's all about how so many people with autism really do have that sense of now, that awareness in the moment. That's so much part of spirituality. And I would just assume that he does understand and act as if, you know, talk in language that's simple if you think that's going to help. But I definitely would try, but I wouldn't shove it down his throat by the same token. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised.
Yes, and that, again, the author is Bill Stillman, STILLMAN.
Uh-huh. Yeah, he's done a lot of writing about people with autism and spirituality.
Okay, now here's Jenna from Rosalia. I have a son who is 6 with autism. I'm here to get some ideas about helping my son enjoy the holiday. Well, I think a lot of it has to do with what we've been mentioning about preparing ahead of time. I don't know if you wanted to mention a few specifics, Lisa?
Preparing ahead of time, preparing the child ahead of time?
All right, because all we know now is about helping the son enjoy the holiday.
Well, I think that part of that is when it's a young child, us understanding enough about that child and what sets them off and what makes them comfortable. And, you know, also giving them warnings about what's coming. So many of our kids are visual learners, not 100% of them. So if we're able to give them visual warnings about what to expect, those are just some things. I mean, that's a very general answer, but it's also a general question, so I'm not quite sure how to get more specific with that.
But I think we've answered it along the way as well, too.
I also found some other articles that I could recommend. Here's something to Google, tips for celebrating holidays with your autistic child. There's 10 tips. It's from the American Chronicle, and it's a very good article. It's one page. So if you just Google in tips for celebrating holidays with your autistic child, that was a really useful article. And actually, even if you just Google autism, autistic children or children with autism in the holidays, you'll find a bunch of internet sites that have articles related to that. So I think there's a lot more help out there.
Okay, here's a question from Christy and Yorba Linda. Hello, I have a 7-year-old boy who is high-functioning, but it seems at Christmas he gets a little withdrawn at the Christmas parties or he won't come out of his room, even if it is people he knows. I'm not sure how to handle him or the situation.
I'm assuming that might be a sensory issue.
I have a feeling of it, too.
Uh-huh. The other thing is that I think so much of our kids' difficulty with controlling their behavior, needing to withdraw, other than if it's not sensory, it's often about feeling a loss of control. And so these Christmas parties are going to be times when their routine is uprooted and it's unpredictable. I mean, I can remember some of the hardest times with my son. He was so stressed. He felt so out of control of his own life that he insisted on turning every light on or off. And if I would turn a light on in a room, he'd get very agitated, and he would turn it off and turn it back on. He needed that control. So I think a lot of times when our kids are withdrawing, if it's not a sensory overload, or maybe it's a combination, it could very well just feel like being out of control, not knowing what's coming, not understanding. And I think, you know, explaining and preparing, and like Chantel talked about social stories, any of those strategies might be helpful, as well as the fact of letting them retreat when they need to, because our kids in their own wisdom know what they need, too. And we have to respect that to some extent, to a great extent.
That was always really hard and disappointing for me because my family is a big French family, and in France, you know, you spend hours at the table for food and for conversation and social events. And when Jeremy was really little, he would sit because he couldn't move very much. You know, he he was very hypotonic, and then when he got older, you know, he'll come and eat a little bit, and then he'll leave, and he'll eat a little bit, and he'll leave. And it's not about him being hyperactive, it's he can't handle the noise. And now we know this for a fact because he can communicate to us, and he will clearly go to the door and open the door and hug and kiss the people, and he's really, you can see the big smile, he's happy to see them. But then he's back upstairs because he can't handle all the noise. But he comes back down every once in a while and stands around and tries to connect, and then he runs back upstairs. And, you know, it's hard. That's just, you know, the way he handles it. And we've tried different sensory things with him, which help. But at the end of the day, if we're constantly worrying about him and whether he's, you know, trying to get him to sit through the whole thing, it's much easier this way because he knows he can come and go, and everyone knows that's Jeremy. And I just had to make it very clear to everyone that even though he's doing that, it's not that he doesn't want them there. He loves having people there. He's happy to have the house full, but he can't be in the same room all the time.
Right. Well said.
Okay, here's again Nancy from Red Lodge, Montana. I have a 5-year-old son with autism. She's the one who wrote about her solution about her 5-year-old who doesn't like opening the gifts.
Right.
She has a question here. I have trouble figuring out a way to balance the holiday dinners. My mom, who is supportive and very understanding of my son's differences, insists on a sit-down formal big dinner. My son does not eat many of the foods and does not enjoy the group of people at the table. He chooses to sit in his room alone, and it breaks my heart. How can I bend this tradition to include my son instead of ostracizing him?
She's not really ostracizing him. He's taking himself away from the situation, correct?
That's what it sounds like. He chooses to sit in his room alone, and it breaks my heart.
I'm wondering if there's anything motivating that could at least invite him to come and spend part of that time there, knowing that he has the choice to get up and leave and go to his room if he needs to go, but that you kind of negotiate with him and then have some kind of something that would be motivating. I mean, without knowing him, I wouldn't be able to speculate what that is. But and I'm not talking about rewarding him with M&Ms or anything like that, but maybe there's some kind of a stim that he knows that he could have at the table, and that if he's able to sit there for 5 minutes or whatever, that something positive will happen that will have some meaning to him to start helping him feel more comfortable. And then if he's old enough to communicate, maybe he could talk a little bit about what is it about sitting at that table that's hard for him, like Jeremy is able to tell Chantal when a situation's difficult. I always like to assume that when our kids do that, that they have a good reason, and we have to become the detectives. And ideally, they're able to work with us and help us teach them about them. I approach my son as an expert about his autism and about his needs, and I invite him to teach me about him, and it's been a wonderful partnership. It wasn't wonderful until we got there. It was really, really hard for many years.
I was also wondering if it would be helpful because Nancy mentions that her son doesn't eat many of the foods. What if there was the plate of foods that he likes to eat that might keep him at the table a little longer? And I was also thinking, I can't imagine the space, but maybe if there was a smaller table that's next to the big table so that he's not right in the middle of everything, if that's too much for him. It really depends on why he doesn't feel that he can sit there. But I think that we need to say, too, that it's what you were talking about, the expectations, because it's very upsetting to Nancy because she would like to have her son participating, but it's more upsetting to her maybe than to her son. So
right.
Kind of over time realizing what part of that I know it's hard because we want to share these moments that we enjoy with our children, but over time it's kind of a realization of how do you make it so that they can participate for part of the time, but then also how do we let go and allow them to be free not to enjoy it since they don't.
Right. Right. I do think, again, we need to start soul-searching ourselves about what's the loss about for us. And it's very normal to feel that loss. But we also don't want to keep putting ourselves through that and to come to terms with who this child is and let go of the dream of who we thought they were going to be. And that's the hard part. And we need people around us when we're doing that who let us feel what we feel. And this is a whole other talk, which I won't go into.
Yeah, we'll have to have you back another time.
I would love that.
We actually just have a couple more minutes, Lisa, and I wanted
okay.
to know if there were any more thoughts that you wanted to share, and also if you would like to give your website so people could find out more information about you, because I think there were some articles on there that would be helpful.
My website is www.disabilityinthefamily.com, and there are a number of articles that I've written that can be downloaded. I think my last words of wisdom are really to make the holidays about who you truly are as a family, rather than trying to live up to something that may not be reasonable. And in fact, you know, if the rituals and the the rituals could end up being even more meaningful because they're based on who you truly are as a family, rather than living up to some cookie cutter model of how it's supposed to be. The other message I want to give to parents is trust your own wisdom about what's right,
Hello?
And even if other people don't.
Lisa?
Yeah.
Well, I think we just lost Lisa there. I think her battery finally went dead.
No, I'm here.
So I guess I'm going to have to finish signing off here for everyone. I hope that you all have a great holiday, regardless of which holiday you celebrate. And if you want, go ahead and write to me your holiday experiences. You can reach me on my website, which is www.chantalcecilekira.com. And also, you can always reach me through the Ask Chantal column of the Autism File magazine, which is a magazine that's out quarterly. And the next one comes out in January. It's in Barnes & Noble and Borders, or you can subscribe on the internet at the Autism File. Or perhaps you'll hear me again back at one of these tele-seminars. So to all of you, I hope that you have a wonderful holiday, and I hope that we've been able to provide some help to you tonight. Take care. Bye now.